an afternoon with Dr. Majid Ali and his wife Talit on Saturday, February 18th at the Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt and Bond Streets in the Borough Hill section of Brooklyn. The event is from 2 to 4 p.m. Sign-ups starts at 1 p.m. Let us all be gracious, grateful, and giving that day.
On Sunday, February 19th at 11 p.m., Suge in My Bowl presents John Else, author of True South, Henry Hampton, and Eyes on the Prize, the landmark television series that reframed the civil rights movement. Join us as we discuss Henry Hampton and the process of making Eyes on the Prize as we help keep this listener-supported experiment alive. That's Sunday, February 19th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Hello and welcome to the Aware Show. I am Lisa Garr, and it is such a great pleasure to be here today. Wow. We've come in for a landing, people. And the good thing is that what we get to do on the Aware Show, and why I love this space so much, is it allows us to kind of ground, take this hour as an oasis for ourselves, and learn some really incredible stuff, really great information. And that is what's happening today. Joining me is Mark Waldman. Now, Mark has been, he's very famous here on the Aware Show. He has been on our airwaves for many, many years talking about neuroscience. He's the author of 14 books, and his, including his bestseller, How God Changes Your Brain, as Oprah selected his book as one of the most read books for 2012. He's also on the executive MBA faculty at LMU, Loyola Marymount University around here. And he is a neurocoach. This is what he does for a living. He maintains a whole practice as a neurocoach. He trains students in his unique, very evidence-based strategies for enhancing personal and professional development. Hello.
Hi, Lisa. It is so wonderful to be here in the studio live with you once again.
I know. I haven't seen you for about a year or so, maybe more.
But we're always in touch with each other.
Yes, that's the good thing. We had a really good time a couple of years ago when we did a recording of this, when we got together in studio and we did some videos on, because I was always so fascinated in what you had to say. And I've done so much research on the brain, nowhere near what you have done. And I interview a lot of people on the brain. But what I loved about your approach is that you really separated the rhetoric. Everybody's become a neuroscientist now. And have you noticed that?
A neuro nerd.
A neuro nerd. Everyone's quoting the norepinephrine and all these things in the brain and acting like a scientist. And it's so great because you really separate the pseudoscience from what
yes.
is actually happening in the brain.
Everybody gets it half wrong, but I get it half right.
And I mean, there's so much research that is coming out about the brain, and there are some basics that we do know and that we can recreate and understand about the importance of neurochemicals in the brain.
Perhaps under 50 There are probably less than 50 facts that we can feel certain about neuroscience.
Really?
So this is still a huge speculative field. The research keeps changing. You can't even go back more than 5 or 6 years to find out that many of the studies that were done in 2001 and 2002 have now been invalidated or found better credibility. So what I like to do, I like to look through about 30 or 40,000 abstracts and papers every year, and I'm just looking for the common threads that are emerging. Then I like to do what would be called practical neuroscience. And there's only about a half dozen of us who can look at these incredible convoluted statements to say, well, okay, here's a particular pattern that we see. And if you do this particular type of task, if you breathe in this particular way, if you stretch in that particular way, if you think in this particular way or daydream or mind wander in another particular way, we begin to see a consistent pattern of what's going on in your brain. And now we can begin to pick and choose, create what I call practical neuroscience, to use this, reverse engineer the studies and say, all right, you want to reduce mental stress? And if you're working with executive MBA students, which I do at LMU, you can't tell them to go sit and meditate and contemplate awareness or go into a relaxation state 20 or 40 minutes in the morning. They wake up. They're already out the door. They're thinking they're going to work 12 to 14, 15 hours a day. So I and my research team, we have to come up with 60-second strategies that will change that person's brain. They will give me 1 minute in the morning and maybe, if I'm lucky, 1 minute once each hour. But we can now have about a dozen strategies that can show you how to get rid of mental stress in 60 seconds or less, how to get rid of physiological stress in 60 seconds or less, how to tap into the intuitive problem-solving, creative problem-solving mechanisms in your brain in 60 seconds or less. Mm. And they love that, and they will do it. Mm. And this is the new movement of what we call mindfulness 3.0.
I love it. So let's do some myth busting, okay?
Okay.
Let's talk about some of the common perceptions around the brain. And you can tell me if they're true or false, okay? We'll do a little game.
Okay.
A little game show here. Okay.
False.
So, I love it. Because I interview all of them, and I know the rhetoric versus the actual science a little bit, a teeny, weeny, weeny bit. But I know that you've busted me many times because I say what I hear, and some of it's absolutely not true. Okay, so does the brain form a neural bundle when you create the same pattern over and over again? True or false?
I think you're actually rather close.
You've got the music.
To true. I'll hit the okay buzzer. Now, before I answer your question, I just want to share with you a little joke that we use in neuroscience. When when two neuroscientists meet and they don't agree on a particular notion, we know that one of them must be wrong. But when two neuroscientists get together and they both agree, we know that both of them have to be wrong.
Why does the science change so fast? It's the same brain.
Well, you have 80 billion neurons, and these aren't just little cells that are fixed. They're actually growing dendrites and axons out in different parts of the brain. So they're like, consider it like a worm with like a millipede or a billipede, where you have 10,000 dendrites growing out from one end of it to collect information from all the other neighboring neurons. And then they can send out as many as 1,000 axons. Like, so you can take a brain cell in the front part of your brain and it can send out a little tiny, microscopic axon that goes all the way back to your visual cortex, which means that when you have a dream or you do a daydream and you imagine something, that information tells the rest of your brain that this is what's actually happening in the outside world. All other animals, all other mammals with a very similar brain that we have, their imagination centers don't really send connections back into the working parts of the brain that are involved with surviving and manipulating themselves in the world. So this is what's kind of amazing. We have developed a frontal lobe that is so filled with imagination and creativity, 1,000 possible things that we could do, 1,000 possible things that could go wrong.
Yes.
And because this is also where consciousness exists, it's right up there in our frontal lobe, we begin to ruminate on the negative stuff or the positive stuff, and the rest of the brain begins to believe that whatever it is you're ruminating on is actually happening in the outside world. It doesn't have the capacity to realize that you're just daydreaming.
Ah, that is so interesting. So that's, well, two things, positive and negative. The positive is...
Shall we come back to the bundle thing, though?
Oh, yes, we have to. Well, okay, I'll just recap that. Is the good thing is it really shows that the visualization really, really does work. On the flip side of that, the negative thinking really, really does work too, because each of them make a physical impact on the brain.
Without positive visualization, your brain won't even know how to motivate itself to go after the goal that you're visualizing. Mm-hmm. But you also have to visualize any potential obstacle so that you can work out a counter strategy mm-hmm. and a plan around it. Once you do the visualization work, so you listen to the negative voices in your head going, no, maybe not, this might happen, whatever else, and you mix it in with the optimistic voices saying, well, yes, but I can do A, B, and C. Now you have a game plan, and if you write it down, because your frontal lobes have inner speech going on, they chatter so fast, about 1,000 times faster than you and I are speaking right now, and we only catch little glimpses of all these positive and negative thought processes that are going on, this inner speech. If you take out a sheet of paper and you write down the negative stuff that's going on, the positive stuff that's going on, the desires that you have, the fears that you have, this slows the process down, and this allows another part of your brain, an awareness center in your brain, to pay closer attention to what's going on in these creative parts. Now you can look at the worries, fears, and doubts. You can look at the hopes, dreams, and optimism, and with it all on paper, you can slowly write down a game plan that will help you achieve your goals. Without the piece of paper, you're not very successful. With the piece of paper, you have a 50% increase in success rate of achieving a goal.
This is why positive thinking doesn't get us out of negative situations, because sometimes you, based on what you just said, you have to call out what is in order to know how it can be.
Yes. And Gabriel Oettingen is probably the world's leading researcher who has really helped to bring the neuroscience and psychology of positive thinking into mainstream psychology and is being supported now by neuroscience. Mm-hmm. So the first step is always to visualize what it is that you want to mm-hmm. achieve. Mm-hmm. You have to start out on that optimistic note. Otherwise, you shut down the motivation centers in your brain. But most people, for example, may think, well, no, don't focus on all the awful things that could happen. You'll make that come true. No, you won't make it come true. Your positive thoughts won't come true, and your negative thoughts won't come true. It's only when you combine the two and you see what the obstacles are and you visualize the obstacle, and then you visualize yourself getting over that obstacle, and you visualize the plan that you're going to use. This is a process that you can do in 60 seconds. You can repeat it throughout the day. You can use it for very simple goals like, I want to lose an extra pound or two. Mm-hmm. I want to find a way of being more productive during the day. I want to improve my concentration. You can go through, and Oettingen calls that the WHOOP process, wish, outcome, obstacle, plan. What is it that you wish? What is it that you desire? What's your goal? Then visualize for a moment, and everyone can do this at home right now. Just close your eyes, unless if you're driving. We have evidence, neuroscientific evidence, showing that if you drive with your eyes closed, it could be hazardous to your health. And you visualize, what will you get from that goal? Now, sometimes people will say, I want to be a billionaire. But they don't know what they would achieve by being a billionaire.
Right.
Because having all that money and having that big house and the car and all of that turns out to not stimulate the parts of your brain that are involved with value, meaning, purpose. So there's no passion in it. Some people have a passion on making money, and they once they make all the money, they go into depression because they haven't thought about what they could do with it.
Mm-hmm. What did you say? The what? W-O-P. I got what
was W-whoop.
W-O-O-P. Oh, two O's.
Wish, outcome. Visualize the outcome that you'll get if your wish comes true. Then visualize the obstacle.
Obstacle. Okay, got it.
Then visualize a plan to overcome the obstacle.
Okay.
A very simple formula. So this is one of the best psychology-based, evidence-based, and brain-based strategies that you have. It's so simple to do. We can all do it.
Okay. Back to the myth-busting game. So the neural bundles. If you practice, so here's an example. My daughter's a goalie, club soccer goalie, and she lost a game pretty badly for, and she felt really, really, really badly for the team. And she was had multiple injuries, and they wound up losing like 6-0 or 6-1. So as a goalie, you feel responsible sometimes because the ball is going by your feet and above your head. And she, we had an hour and a half drive home, and she was in tears most of the drive home. And I was not going to sit there and say, it's okay, it's okay. Not to make her, not, you know, by any means to make her feel bad about losing the game, but I remember you saying you need to call out the feeling of upset, disappointment before you can get to the plan on how to fix it, not to gloss over that.
Well, historically, right? In the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of pop psychologies that said it was very important to express your feelings and emotions, whatever they are. That was part of being authentic. That's what Esalen Institute was built on. That's what Gestalt therapy was built on. But then all of this research came in showing that if you say out loud, if I let myself get angry like that, right at this very moment, even though I'm faking this angry tone of voice, I'm releasing stress neurochemicals in my brain. It's triggering stress neurochemicals in your brain. It's like pouring acid over the memory and learning centers in your brain. It doesn't work. So this is where the mindfulness research came in. So when you feel angry or you feel upset or you feel frightened or you feel
disappointment,
love, caring, instead of expressing it, savor it. And what I mean by savoring is just to sit back, close your eyes if you possibly can, relax your mind and body through a few yawns, a few stretches, and then sit with the feeling and let it flow through your consciousness. If you don't try to do anything, because the definition of mindfulness is moment-to-moment awareness of any thoughts, feelings, memories, sensations, without judging it. So you sit there. And so if you can, so if you could teach your daughter, say, yes, you feel that way. Let that feeling flow through you. Watch it. You end up developing what's called an observing self. So here you are crying, or even, you know, it's a little harder when you're angry. Angry just turns off your ability to be aware of anything. It always feels like I am right and you are wrong when you get angry. But sadness is a very important feeling to have. It's a sense of loss. So sure, she was in the game. She was trying to win. She did A, B, C, and D, and, quote, she failed. That's a disappointment. The sadness is the brain's way of absorbing that loss. If you can allow yourself to sit with that sadness and watch it, you'll see that the sadness doesn't stay put. It moves in and out. It keeps going through different layers. So you could ask your daughter, well, tell me more. What does that sadness feel like? What does it bring up? Are there any memories associated with that? What do you think about your own sadness? And then you can go back and forth between experiencing a raw gut emotion, or I should say a raw, deeper midbrain emotion, and using your thought processes to evaluate it. There'll be positive thoughts about that feeling, negative thoughts, but we want to teach mindfulness because it stimulates a different part of your brain, a deeper part of your brain. That's I'll usually talk about the anterior cingulate and insula. It's part of the social brain. This is where empathy takes place. This is where self-love develops. And it's the last part of the brain to come fully online. It's barely developed in a 28-year-old. So how old is your daughter?
13.
She's 13.
Yeah.
She's just beginning.
Yeah. That's why I didn't want to embed it in there at this point to have this negative experience around. I was worrying what
to do
about it.
So if you sit there mindfully, compassionately holding that space, following it, having her make sure she doesn't cut it off, but to keep going with the sadness and see where it takes her, you encourage her to say, watch this. It's going to shift and change. Share with me how that sadness changes.
That's a good way of reframing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Then it flows.
So it goes back to the original question I had about the bundles, about the neural bundles. Does the brain create a hard wiring based on that kind of experience repetitively?
Well, yes. You're talking about learned behavior. You're talking about habits. And anything we repeat over and over and over again, when we're first learning something, we're using, again, our creative frontal lobes or decision-making centers, the parts that say, okay, I'm going to pick this pencil up. I'm going to bring this piece of paper. I'm going to learn how to shape if I'm going to learn how to write. And then the more you do it, the more it forms stronger and stronger memory circuits that become less flexible. And these memory pockets, shall we say, mm-hmm. they're scattered throughout the brain. Those become automatic behavior. Now, what happens tomorrow when you wake up, you don't really think about, you're not thinking about right now how you're holding that pen in your hand.
Right.
You've been doing it for so long. But the moment you bring your attention to it, it starts to feel different.
Yes.
That's mindfulness. Oh, I'm becoming aware of these old habits and behaviors that I have formed. And now, the moment you bring awareness to it, those memory circuits begin to change. You're calling up an old memory or behavior from the past, but you're doing so in a different state of mind. And if that state of mind is worrisome, so if you bring up a negative memory, oh, there I go again, I'm failed, you know, I'm a perfectionist, I wanted to go clean up my room, I didn't clean up my room, I'm stuck with this problem. You're building new memory circuits that you're stuck with this problem, you can't do anything about it. But if you bring up the old memory, the behavior that you don't like, but you do so when you're relaxed, when you're open-minded, when you're in a positive inquiry state, some of that relaxation, some of that open-mindedness gets reconsolidated into the old memory. Then the next time that memory comes up, there's a little bit of pleasure. There's a little bit of hope. There's a little bit of neutrality and optimism. And that's how you can change old memory circuits in your brain.
That is a great definition of changing it, being the observer, having the mental awareness of it, and allowing the thoughts to pass through in a state of awareness, expanded awareness, rather than in the state of anger, because that embeds it in even further.
And that's what we're calling mindfulness.
Mindfulness. Wow. Mark Waldman, by the way, is my guest. We had a wonderful, wonderful time sitting down and recording eight different videos that describe the functions of the brain. I mean, he talks so much about this, and we really dissected it. We learned about how inside living brain works and different types of what we just talked about, negative, positive thoughts. We learned about money, motivation, and happiness. Now, I'm going to explain these a little bit. I want to mention that you can get these for the fund drive. And the number here is 516-620-3602. This is Cutting Edge Neuroscience. And the title of it is, you're going to love this title, The Neuroscience of Happiness and Wealth. And it is a $125 pledge to WBAI, which is so wonderful because you get this amazing gift of, you know, rewinding and looking at it again, and rewinding and embedding in this great learning in a neutral way, but taking it on and finding out how to do things differently. So money, motivation, and happiness. And keep the phone lines ringing, by the way. The number is 516-620-3602. Why is money, motivation, and happiness linked?
Well, our newest research shows that when it comes to a choice between happiness and wealth, your brain could care less about happiness because it's primarily motivated towards wealth. Seeing the image of a single coin for 1/20th of a second while I have you in a brain scan machine
really?
Will stimulate a whole set of neurochemicals that make you more motivated, that make whatever action that you're doing more vigorous. Your brain loves the image of money because a single coin, even for a young child, represents all the things that child can get. And we're all born with an incredibly greedy brain. That brain, I mean, all of you who have kids know this. You can hand your kid one toy, and what's the very next thing that your kid says to you within 5 minutes? I want that toy. I want another toy. You can't give your kid enough Beanie Babies. There's still another Beanie Baby coming out.
Oh, God.
And then that moves into social greed as well. I want that friend. I want to play with that friend's toy. I want to do this. I want to do that. We have an I want a brain. And it's
I want more likes on Facebook.
Yes.
Yes.
All of that. And there's never any end to it. So greed is the fundamental default situation of all brains.
Wow.
Starting out from a sponge, which just has a loose neural net, to the worm, who's basically, you know, the brain sits on top of the mouth of a worm, so it's directing the mouth towards all the things it wants. It wants nurturance, and we want the same things. We want more knowledge if we feel that that knowledge will help us get a better job, or we just love the experience of learning. We certainly can use, the money that we have to ensure our family's well-being. We always like to ask our students and workshop participants the following question. If you were given a choice between being the wealthiest person in the world or the happiest person in the world, which would you choose? And I can even tell by the way your face lit up with a smile when I mentioned happiness, 90% of the audience will say, I want
to be happy.
I want to be happy. But here's the thing. If you think about it for a moment, and if I ask you, what images come to mind when I ask you, well, what is happiness?
Laughter, peace, joy.
Did you notice that you started out with
Yeah.
You had to think. Yeah. Now, let me ask you this question. What is wealth? How do you visualize wealth?
Money.
See how quickly your answer was?
Oh, yeah.
So the brain knows what wealth is. It's the acquisition of anything that will enhance or improve your life.
Right.
You put a mouse in a maze and you put all kinds of unusual objects it's never seen. What does it do? Does it ignore it? No, it collects them, gathers them, and puts them in a corner because it may be valuable down the road. Now you understand hoarding behavior in human beings. It's the notion that I'm going to collect all this stuff because it may be useful for me later.
What about abundance?
Well, this is the thing. Research has shown that those who pursue happiness end up becoming clinically depressed.
Oh, my God. Is abundance a thing that a mouse could stick in a corner?
Okay. What's the first image that comes to mind for abundance for you?
Abundance of something, lots of a plethora of something.
See how something, hard?
Yeah,
see how hard you're having? You have three ums in that particular one. Your brain, we go back to the whoop thing. If you cannot visualize your goal, the brain doesn't know how to go after it.
Right. I'm like envisioning the mouse in the hole with the cheese. He's got the cheese.
And that mouse doesn't sit back and say, I want abundance. No, it just says, I want more, and it visualizes something more.
Cheese.
So yes. If you need knowledge, okay, images of books come to mind. Going to college comes to mind. Going to do the internet. You can visualize that. So your goal has to be oriented towards something concrete that you can visualize.
Here's abundance isn't concrete enough.
Mm. Well, our newest book is called NeuroWisdom, and the whole premise of this book is based on that question of happiness or wealth. Now, when we ask people to close their eyes and to visualize yourself, Lisa, you are now the wealthiest person in the world. You have income that puts Bill Gates and Warren Buffett to shame. You have so much money you don't know how to do that, and I'm going to give you all that money right now, okay?
Okay.
Feels good, yes?
Yes.
All right. But there's a hitch.
Okay.
All neuroscientific research is based on all these little experiments that we do around money games, for example. In this particular hitch, you have to give away 90% of that money. In other words, you're only going to be left with $1 billion for personal spending.
Okay.
I don't know if you can squeeze by Warren Buffett
for me.
You know how to live on a $500 million or more. So, but now you have that other $50 billion to give away. You have to give it away to something that you're going to manage and oversee. What do you want to do with that $50 billion? So just take a moment and think about all the things that you could do if you were the wealthiest person in the world. Think about the people you could help. Think about the projects that you could engage in without any kind of restriction. Think of how easy it would be to hire anybody you wanted. As one of our students once said, "This well, if I'm a miserable individual, I'll just hire the best therapist in the world to become happy." What would you do with your billions?
Oh, I would put it into technologies to restore renewable energies. I would eradicate hunger. I would bring in think tanks and ideas on how to solve conflict in the world. I mean, there's so much I would do with it.
Tell me how you are feeling right now as you describe to me that fantasy.
Oh, great. Wonderful.
Now, for those of you who are listening, can you hear how Lisa's voice became softer, more melodic?
Mm.
That's a quality that this is the neural equivalent of not only happiness, but purpose, meaning, enjoyment, passion. And you couldn't see her face, but her face had this beautiful, bliss-like Mona Lisa smile as she was describing that.
The first thing that I thought when you said about the money is that I would sleep. Let me get some sleep.
No, here's another.
That'd be really great.
Here's another brain fact.
So it made me laugh.
You're a huge, excessive, imaginatory frontal lobes where all this creativity takes place. Never goes to sleep. It's even more active when you think you're resting than when you're awake and focusing on a task. But here's my question to you now. Now, given a choice between being the happiest person in the world or being the wealthiest person in the world, which would you choose?
The wealth would bring me the happiness to support these causes that I really know we can change in the world.
And we did this with 1,000 people in the audience, and 90% of their people changed their thing.
Yeah.
But here's here's what's really important about it. It's a trick question. Because remember, you have a greedy brain, so it wants happiness and wealth. It wants everything. Here is the trick. You can have both. If you use this exercise and imagine what you would do with extraordinary wealth, you have actually unlocked a neurological secret of what is uniquely passionate for you. So I recommend that everyone do this exercise, write down that vision, and even though you and I don't have that money to do that, you and I can both do something in the next week to move us one step closer towards that vision.
Can
That's
I tell you
passion.
That a great little story is I just interviewed this man, Larry Brilliant, Dr. Larry Brilliant, and he is responsible for eradicating smallpox around the world. And he had spent many, many years with the Maharishi and his guru and meditating and seeking. And his guru finally said, get out of the ashram and go fulfill your mission on this planet, which is to eradicate a specific disease, smallpox. First thing he did was went to the UN and he got a job as a secretary because he had, you know, maybe $500 to his name. And he went and got that job as a secretary, and through the job as a secretary, worked his way up. Now, the main thing that he does is he raises money for funding for the research to be able to create this new type of technology to find areas that are impacted by disease. And I mean, it's just so, it's a perfect example as someone who had no money, but yet needed to raise money in order to get to the technology to eradicate the smallpox. And he's on to the next disease and the next pandemic and the next epidemic right now. And it's amazing what you can do.
Yes, he's following his passion. And then it's no longer about money, but what you can do with money. And that's what the research shows.
Yeah.
The research actually shows that your income predicts happiness. And it doesn't stop. Even all the way up to $250,000, the more income you have, the happier you are. And this is a world figure. It's put out by the United Nations World Happiness Report.
Fascinating. What you can do with it. Look what this man is doing with the raising the money. He's eradicating disease around the world.
Now, here's something that's very interesting. Because there are some people, they're so obsessed with making money, and they're still mired in that greedy brain.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what happens with another person who's watching somebody being greedy. It creates such a rage reaction deep inside of your brain that that person will actually punish you even if it costs them money to do so.
Wow.
And this,
I've seen that happen. Yes, yes.
And this threw away, you know, Nash won the Nobel Prize for game theory because – the research shows that we have a greedy brain, so you should always be doing everything you can to win the most amount of money and keep the most amount of money. So people began to create money games and play these games, and what would happen? And we set up an ultimatum game. And it's like you and I may have, like, shall we say, $101 bills lying on the table between us.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll play this particular game. And I'm going to choose how to divide up that money between the two of us. The money is here for both of us, whatever else. But I get to set up the division thing, and I can divide it up in all kinds of ways. If you don't like my way to divide the money, you can say no deal, and we both have to leave the room without any money either. So there's $100 in there. I'm going to say, Lisa, I'm going to take $99 and leave you with $1.
I don't like that.
Okay.
So we're not leaving.
So we both lose.
Yeah, we both leave with nothing.
But you see, this is what violated Nash's Nobel Prize winning economic theory. Basically, and in my executive MBA class, there'll always be students who'll say, "Yeah, I'll take the $1. Why not? I'm $1 richer. I may not like you for doing that." But you decided to punish yourself. You could have had a reward of $1.
Interesting, right.
But let me just change the numbers a little bit on this one.
Ah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There is $100 million on the table there.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to make the same unfair division. I'm going to take $99 million and leave you with $1 million on that table. Do you accept that and walk away $1 million richer?
Uh-huh.
Or do you reject it and you have $1 million less to help out all those people that you wanted to help out with your philanthropic cause?
Interesting. I think I would – I have a need for justice here that's coming up.
That's the biology part of your brain.
I have the need for justice, yeah. But I also understand that if that money was purely going to help people, that I would take the $1 million and help the people with it. Yeah, absolutely.
What these brain games show is that two basic fundamental principles exist. You have a greedy brain, but you also have a brain that insists that everybody else in your community be fair.
I do, yeah.
It
doesn't get me very far.
Well, this is even true in many religious communities. If you have a lot of money, you are expected to help out those who don't have money. You're expected to be fair, to share, to be generous. Here's the cool stuff about reverse engineering some of the neuroscience research that I do. When you train your brain to be more self-loving, more confident, when you use mindfulness and meditation practices, the social brain becomes stronger and stronger. You feel more generous towards others. You end up acting more fairly towards others. Others have more respect for you, and then it's a win-win situation for everyone.
Fascinating. Well, these are the types of things that you will learn by watching these videos. And there's exercises. There's interactive exercises in the videos. And also, I mean, these are techniques that will help you, your loved ones, if you're a parent, help your children. It's really interesting. Now, we're talking about fundraising also, which is interesting in this topic of money, because as people call, it's a $125 donation to the radio station. But I've always said, in terms of donations, that you may donate $125 to WBAI, but what you're really gaining is so much more than that money. It's a value difference. They're gaining knowledge and tools and techniques that could actually help people increase their overall finances, quality of life, focus on their values a lot more. I mean, there's so much more that you would gain that you can't put a price tag on.
In fact, well, we can put a price tag on it. You're actually, everyone listening to this program, you'll get over $1,000 worth of some of the best video programs you and I have ever created. These have some of the most effective brain-changing strategies that we've been able to document in our books and research. But here's another cool neuroscientific fact. When you choose to be generous, to be philanthropic, when you give to charity, and you give the amount of money that feels right to you, this releases a set of neurochemicals that reinforces the happiness, the contentment, and the satisfaction circuits in your brain. So
Absolutely. Giving
what feels right to you turns out to be a neurologically enhancing exercise.
Mm. I absolutely agree. I've done it before. When you are of contribution to someone else or a greater cause than you, the reward is priceless. It is. It's truly. So here's the number. If you call us right now, 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, your donation, your contribution to this wonderful radio station that keeps the station thriving and alive and able to distribute content and information like we are right now, that is a wonderful service, and thank you so much. And in return, you get these amazing videos. Now, these are 8 videos. First, I'll just name the titles right now. This NeuroZen, Inside the Living Brain.
That's one of my favorite ones because I'm actually going to show you what the brain looks like. These aren't sterile set cells, like I said in the beginning of this talk. They're moving around. When you're young, some neurons move from the back of your brain to the front of the brain, from the front of the brain to the back of the brain. You know, it's part of the neuroplasticity of the brain. So you'll have a chance to see these actual videos of how neurons begin to grow and divide, how they connect with each other. You basically have, these are separate organisms. These are living creatures. It's basically Facebook on steroids, how they interact. And sometimes, the more, it's interesting because one of the videos that is probably the most profoundly shocking and moving to all of my students, I'll show a video of what happens with a neuron when it's under stress, and you watch it implode. Mm-hmm. You watch it die. That's what stress does.
Yeah.
That's why all of our research is always starting out with, before you do anything, take 60 seconds to de-stress your brain with just a few mindful yawns. Take 30 seconds to just do a super slow stretch to immerse yourself in how that body actually feels. You've already prepared your brain to perform better for the next hour of work.
Wow, that's fascinating. I find that with doing this radio show, with doing the Aware Show, is that this is, as I said at the very beginning of the show, this is my oasis. I get to focus on one thing. I don't have to multitask. And I can really just, that it really calms my brain to be here in the space and with you and speaking. It's amazing.
And you and I have also done yawning fests as well.
Oh my gosh, yes, we have.
And although it may sound very strange, we do have over 60 studies now showing that yawning is the fastest way to eliminate mental stress and to help you become more focused on any task you're about to do.
Fascinating. I yawn a lot when I work out. Okay, so here's the number, 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. The other topics we talked about, money, motivation, and happiness in the brain. We talked a daily commitment sheet. And this is a way to, through a live demonstration, and this is something you can use over and over and over again, how to address why thoughts, feelings, and actions may be derailing your success and how you can stay on track with this specific process. And we talked about this earlier, right?
This is one of the simplest and most powerful sheets of paper that we've ever created. Again, our executive MBA students are given it and use it all the time. And so you basically start out in the morning. You do a little bit of relaxation and focusing. And then you ask yourself, what is one specific goal that you want to achieve for that particular day? Then you go through that whoop process. Visualize that goal. Visualize the obstacles. Visualize any sabotage behavior that could come up. And just write down on the sheet of paper a couple of notes of how you might sabotage yourself, what the obstacle might be. Then quickly write down a couple of simple strategies to overcome that obstacle. Then another exercise on that one sheet of paper is that you use your power words and value words. Like you close your eyes and you think about what is one word that would capture the essence of what I want to bring into the next hour of work. It might be confidence. It might be serenity. It might be focus. It might be peacefulness. It might be, the word that comes to my mind right now is just stay connected with Lisa and with the audience to create a wonderful flow. And I anchor myself with that word over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And brain scan studies and neurogenetic studies show that this will turn on 1,200 stress-reducing genes,
wow,
which means that you'll have less stress for that next hour of work. Then, at the end of the day, instead of thinking about all the things that you failed to do and need to do and hope to do, just take another couple of minutes to focus on two or three things you did well, the little tiny goals you've accomplished, and the few things you feel grateful for. If you did this for 7 days in a row on paper, just writing down what you did well, mm-hmm, and what you feel grateful for, and then you stopped after 7 days, positive psychology research showed that your self-esteem continues to grow over the next 3 months.
Fascinating. Wow, what an investment. That's great.
And the important thing about these videos is that, yeah, you and I work together. I'll guide you through some of the exercises. I'll guide the viewers through these exercises. These are very practical exercises. And it's much more powerful than reading them from a book when you're or listening to them on the radio, because there we want to guide you through these exercises. They're just 2, 3, 4 minutes long, each one. And this is how you begin to change those old memory patterns, how you build new habits of learning how to focus, stay relaxed, achieve your goals, remain optimistic, ignore, interrupt all of that negative chatter
that's so valuable.
Normal part of your prefrontal lobe.
All right, so I'm going to ask the audience right now to call us. Now, this is anyone out there who has a brain. This is a this is a product for you because it is...
I thought we weren't going to make any political jokes.
Anyone who has something between their ears, I want to emphasize the absolute value of your brain. All decisions are made, all intentions are made. Everything that you do, your state can be changed in an instant using the power of your mind. And brain, mind, we'll go through that also. But the point is, everything that you do begins with a decision, and it is the decisions that you make that shape your destiny. Tony Robbins says this. And so if those decisions can be really, truly controlled by you instead of them controlling you, you are actually in charge. You are the captain of the ship. You are in charge of your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions. Think of how much more you can do. Are you living at the effect of your life, or are you affecting your life? This is why this knowledge is so valuable. And Mark and I sat down, and I'm the host and Mark's the expert, and we talk about these great stimulating topics on how to be in charge of that command center of your life. And that's why I'm so passionate about you not only supporting the station and the fun drive, that's great, but this is really about you getting in charge of your mind and your brain and getting in control of your life in a way that's effective so that you can make a greater impact in the world, so that you can be of greater service. You've got a body in this lifetime. Let's do something with it. Let's make something of your world. And regardless of excuses and circumstances and all of that, you can overcome. And we talk about the brain science on how to let go of those stories and create new purpose in life, find value, find meaning, and move towards what gives you value and meaning in life. And it does really have to do with calling out the negativity. We even talk about in video 6, creating a crap board, which is all of the conflicts, resistance, anxiety, and problems, that's CRAP, that you believe are holding you back, and then calling all of those out in a physical piece of paper, addressing those negative feelings, and then learning how to deal with them effectively. There's a reason for that, right?
Yes, it's one of those few rare, remarkable discoveries that Andy Newberg and I stumbled across in our research on spirituality in the brain. We found that if you take a sheet of paper and you write down every worry, fear, and doubt you have, every weakness you have, even write down all the things that your friends and colleagues would say are your problems, and then you put that sheet of paper down in front of you, and again, do a mindful yawn, a mindful stretch, bring yourself into the present moment, and just gaze at that piece of paper. You'll watch how all of those worrisome thoughts that you had, as you read them on a piece of paper, there's a neurological disconnect, and you feel this inner sense of calmness and peacefulness looking at your own crap, the conflicts, uh-huh, resistances, anxieties, and stuff like that. It's an amazing exercise, and Lisa and I will guide you through that step by step. We'll be right there in your living room with you doing this, and you'll find that it's one of the funniest and one of the most productive exercises that you can do.
Absolutely. This whole concept of mindfulness is very much addressed in these videos. Again, you can give us a call at 516-620-3602. And there are things, of course, that are upsetting in life. There are annoyances. There are disappointments in life. Those are going to happen, but you have the choice whether or not to give those moments of disappointment or people or situations any power. You have that choice. That lies right here within you. You can, if you give those moments power, you make them greater than you and they reside over you. But in the state of mindfulness, you can diffuse that power and take your power back over those moments. And then you're in charge about how you react to those circumstances around you. It's such a different conversation than being at the effect of things or affecting things. This is how you change that. And it all happens within these 5 little inches right between your ears. It's simple. It can happen in an instant too.
The brain is just a pain-pleasure organism. Anything that causes it pain, which includes your negative thoughts, it just causes a reaction. It pulls your body back away from the world. The problem is, how do you pull yourself back away from your own negative thoughts? So you do have to learn the mindfulness practice. When you sit there and you watch all your positive, negative thoughts, and they, too, just constantly flow in and out of consciousness, it never shuts up the frontal lobe. And as you sit there and you watch all these positive thoughts and negative thoughts and old memories that come up, suddenly you begin to notice that, wait a minute, I'm sitting here and watching my thoughts like I'm sitting in a movie theater, watching them on a screen. I'm not the movie. I'm not my negative thoughts.
You're the observer of them.
And it's an aha experience. And with that kind of awareness, you can realize, and this is a very important thing I repeat over and over and over again, 90% of all of your worries, fears, and doubts are nothing more than memories from the past being projected onto the future. They are not real.
But they do create real chemicals. So if you go through that negative thinking and if you go into that
Only if you ruminate on them. Mm-hmm. If you watch them, the chemicals that are being emitted are the empathy chemicals or the confidence chemicals or the peacefulness chemicals or the dopamine that's actually motivating you to do more of it. It feels good. Remember, the brain pulls away from anything that's painful, but it moves towards anything that's pleasurable. And so what we have to realize is that as we're moving towards our goal, just stop once every hour and do something that's pleasurable for 60 seconds. Take a 60-second pleasure break.
Cool.
And this will recirculate the spent neurochemicals that are involved with goal achievement.
So let's talk about reward for a second. We have this wonderful radio station. We're raising money for this radio station. Right now, I'm trying to get a count from the phone room of how many of these have gone. And we're looking... Okay, we're going to get a count in just a second. So we're going to increase. Let's see if we can get 5 people to give us a call. 5 more people right now to give us a call. 516-620-3602. Neuroscience is as useful as any diet, any nutritional aspect, anything that you do, because it gives you and your understanding of the reward centers in the brain that make you want to eat healthy, that make you want to have good conversations and healing relationships, that make you want to motivate yourself to create finances and so forth. Understanding the neuroscience is at the basis of everything that you do. So it's not a magic pill. It's not a diet. It's not a get rich quick scheme. It's the basis of everything that you do for the brain to understand moving towards pain or moving towards pleasure. And so you get to be in charge and make the decisions of which way you want to go and be the observer of the painful situation so that you're not hooked by it, so that the chemicals do not cascade, and understanding the rewards of the pleasure part of the brain. Now, this is through values, rewards, the brain constantly is seeking those things, right?
Yes. And we never knew that before. I mean, when Descartes, who created, quote, the scientific revolution, he basically made a separation between body and mind. But what few people know is that he still considered that the mind came in from the ethers outside and came through your pineal gland. We now know that the pineal gland doesn't do that. We know exactly how consciousness is created through the motivation centers of your brain. Anything that you see that's new, interesting, different, suggesting some possible reward, maybe greater intimacy, more pleasure, more wealth, more happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Dopamine gets released and it moves right into the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, which is right above your eyeballs. And this is where consciousness is born. This is where you now have the ability to be aware of what that motivational desire was. And because you have these huge frontal lobes, you have huge ability to dream up all kinds of possible solutions that nobody else could do.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is why this is important, and I'm really wanting to emphasize the fact that all decisions are made through this power of your mind. So getting knowledge and control over these decisions is really at the basis of every single thing that you hear, all the decisions that you make. Do you ever wake up in the morning and you just go right to the negative thinking and you have to actually exercise or work out to get those thoughts to change to the positive way of thinking? This is because the dopamine that starts to release during exercise can actually change your thoughts. Knowledge does the same thing, right?
Well, here's one of the quirks of the human brain. Mm-hmm. It turns out that all brains are basically designed to record negative experiences from the outside world. So that protects it from making the same mistake or stepping into the same danger in the past.
Interesting.
So again, you can see where the problem is going to be if you have all these negative fantasies going on. Those are also building up in memory circuits. Then, whenever you step into a similar situation, those old negative memories come forth first. So we have a propensity to think negatively first. We actually have to train our brains to watch the negativity with neutrality, and then we have to turn up the volume on the positivity. That's why I said at the end of the day, you just write down three things you did well, three things you feel grateful for. You, in essence, from what Fredrickson's research shows and Losada's in the business world and Gottman in the relationship world shows, if you don't generate a minimum of 3 to 5 positive thoughts and feelings for every negative thought or worry or doubt that goes through your head, your relationships will collapse, and so will your businesses.
Wow. See, this is why we spend so much time this hour talking about the information. And now it is time for you to go into action, to pick up the phone and give us a call. 516-620-3602. Let's see 10 people right now pick up the phone and say yes to empowering your brain. Say yes to being able to reduce stress, to increase problem-solving ability, to understand the importance of mindfulness. Everyone can do this. And it's just a matter of picking up the phone right now, giving us a call. 516-620-3602, donating $125 to the station. And I must tell you, when you speak with the volunteers in the phone room, please give them your email address. This is a digital product only. So that means you don't have to worry about shipping, and we're being green with this one. We are definitely allowing this to come through your inbox for your computer. So you're going to need an email address to give to the volunteers in the phone room. I see the lines being picked up right now. Thank you so much for calling. 516-620-3602. We've got 5 people calling. Let's get 5 more people in right now. 516-620-3602. You, driving right now, stop, pull over, and say yes to committing yourself to a stress-free environment by educating yourself, by learning. Would you like better problem-solving abilities? Would you like to decrease stress in your life? Would you like to find out more useful ways of creating finances, relationships? This is information, and the information is at your fingertips. Call it. 516-620-3602.
And I want you to do one other brain game for a moment that has to do with that money, wealth, happiness question I asked you earlier. Visualize for a moment that $125 going to keep alive a radio station that reaches millions of individuals. So your small, tiny, generous contribution can help millions of other people throughout the world learn how to use these brain-changing strategies.
Great.
To reduce stress, to become happier, to build greater confidence. Take a moment and think about how many people can be reached by keeping these public nonprofit organizations going.
Yeah, that's a great point. Your contribution helps millions of people and has for 55 years. This is such an incredible organization that is 95% volunteer run.
So this is what we teach at the LMU Business School now. This is what Harvard University teach. This generosity comes first. The more generous you are, the more you stimulate those parts of your brain that bring you the deepest sense of lifelong happiness and satisfaction and contentment. Mm-hmm. Generosity first, and then you will get a gift from us to help saturate and satiate your greedy brain.
That's wonderful. Generosity and gifts. So thank you so much. Keep calling 516-620-3602. You have 1 minute left to please call us. Your contribution of $125 helps millions of people by supporting public radio and keeping us on the air. And also the wonderful gift, which is priceless, is learning about your brain and how to use it. Thank you so much, Mark Waldman. I love speaking with you.
Thank you so much. And you have less than 60 seconds to change your brain and the brains of millions of other people. Yeah. Have a wonderful day.
Great. Until next time, I invite you to stay aware.
WBAI listeners don't sound like this guy.
I'm very proud now that we have a museum, the National Mall, where people can learn about Reverend King, so many other things. Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
RSVP today for the DC Arts and Culture Tour, February the 25th through the 26th. This overnight weekend trip includes transportation, a night stay at the Embassy Row Hotel, silent disco dinners, and of course, museums, including an entire day at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. So you can learn about Frederick Douglass and walk through Black history from 1400 to today. Spots are going every day and the trip is limited to the first 28 people who pledge. Make your pledge today. Go to WBAI.org and click on the DC Arts Tour. Let's go to DC, folks, so you don't sound like this guy.
The contributions of Frederick Douglass will become more and more.
Hi, this is Donovan, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Well, as I was saying to Ellen Datlow just now, I'm trying to get my thumb drive up here so I can play my intro music. But, you know, can that happen? I have myself to blame for this, because we could have come here a little earlier, and we didn't, but that's because of me. Ooh, am I getting a level on my microphone? Let me see. No. Okay. 1, 2, 1, 2. Could you say something into your mic?
Hello?
Ah, yes.
You getting me?
I'm getting you. I'm not getting me.
Okay.
Or at least I'm not getting me in my headphones. Yeah. Okay. We are sabotaged. Ah, here we go. We are slightly sabotaged here, which means that you tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio, New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And normally I would have music for you, but we're on a new schedule now. Not just that we're on a fund drive, but Catherine Davis is now on Monday afternoons and has vacated the midnight to 1:30 slot. Health programming, curiously, will be on from midnight to 1, and then Hour of the Wolf from 1 till 3 a.m. So mote it be. I'm very glad to get the extra half hour, and I have to acclimate to that. But you know what? I think I can actually start my theme music, as if by magic. and good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, editor Ellen Datlow.
At this time, the National Space Administration requires all aliens to register. Forms are available at your local post office. Those without forms must appear, however briefly, at the Bureau's astral offices on Nooker Street. Aliens, register now.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. One of the better moments of the Lego Batman movie comes hard after one of its worst. They're both in the same sequence, actually. On the good side, near the beginning of the film, after a prelude in which Batman vanquishes the Joker, who gets away anyhow, and what appears to be the full roster of Dark Knight adversaries with a few ridiculous additions thrown in, we get to see Batman at home in an island isolated Wayne Manor, and after all the public adoration, it's a pretty grim sight. He shoves some leftover lobster thermidor into a microwave, eats it alone, watches Jerry Maguire for the umpteenth time, and laughs at the You Complete Me scene. Director Chris McKay goes for long, static shots here, keeping Bruce in his cowl, even in his off hours, a perhaps oblique reference to the common insight that the Batman is the real person within the Wayne facade. The stillness is a shocking contrast after the kinetics of the opener, and quite successful in building empathy. The bad of this is that the sequence begins with Batman returning to the Batcave, him walking a lengthy hydraulic pathway as the vast bat arsenal, all the various Batmobiles, Batplanes, what have you, are displayed to him on robotic platforms. On the one hand, this is a proper way to kick off the sequence. It underlines that Bats has all the wonderful toys, but lacks for the human contact that would make it all worthwhile. But this is a Lego movie, and as each bit of Bat paraphernalia, all of course constructed of Lego brand building pieces, drifts across the screen, you can easily envision the marketing arms of both Warner Brothers, which produced the film, and the Lego company rubbing their hands in glee at all the Toys R Us shelves that will be crowded with million-piece Batman-themed building sets. This is the conundrum of a movie franchise born of many mothers, licensed from a toy product, first becoming cutscenes for video games, then those turning into TV series and made-for-video cartoons. In the first theatrical extension of this franchise, The Lego Movie, which I didn't find quite as radical as a lot of people did, they got around this by embracing what is supposed to be the core mission of Lego, to inspire imagination and creativity.
something which ironically the Lego manufacturers have been criticized for abandoning the further they embraced licensing movie and comics characters. But while the Lego Batman movie occasionally makes nods to Lego physics, the fact that anything in the Lego universe can be deconstructed to make other things, that happens mostly on the peripheries of a scene, with prime screen time taken up with copious pop references. By the end of the film, the list of bad guys has extended beyond the DC universe to include, among others, Voldemort and the Daleks, and a lot of fourth wall breaking, frequently to comment on the various incarnations of Batman over the years. In many ways, the Lego Batman movie more closely resembles one of the short, direct-to-video superhero films that used the Lego franchise and that paved the way for these features, and even those took better advantage of the reinvention concept. Frankly, I grew kind of bored by the film. You could easily have removed the Lego aspect from it and its frenetic, almost desperate lunging for jokes at any cost. I'm not sure why Michael Jackson's The Man in the Mirror was supposed to be funny, but apparently it is, becomes glaringly obvious. There is, at some point, an attempt to lay out a theme of interconnectivity by having the Lego figures literally interconnect, but by then it's too little too late. The Lego Batman movie is satire that's too distracted to figure out what exactly it's making fun of, and that's no fun. On to something better. A young princess wanders her kingdom and stumbles upon a monster trapped in a tower. Or maybe it's not a monster. Maybe it's some harmless creature imprisoned by her father under the influence of a mysterious succubus. Not too surprising a setup, except that this tale is called American Fable. The kingdom is actually Wisconsin. The time is the early 80s, when farmers were struggling and suicide wasn't an inconceivable option to solving one's financial woes. And the monster is a businessman imprisoned by the girl's father at the goading of a mysterious woman in red to save his farm. There are times when director Ann Hamilton seems satisfied with using the fable part of that title to elide some lapses in motivation for her characters and an ending that doesn't quite tie up all the loose ends, but she gives a beautiful pastoral burnish to the darkness of her story and gets a great, alternately dreamy and alert performance from Peyton Kennedy as a girl being awakened from the cocoon of childhood to an awareness of the not at all comforting realities of the world beyond. American Fable is kind of like Pan's Labyrinth filtered through Fargo. It is a haunting experience. You could easily envision the new film Stray Bullets as the work of a Tarantino-smitten 17-year-old who wanted to create his own Reservoir Dogs knockoff. There's lots of swearing and gunfire and honor amongst a trio of thieves who are being chased by an uncommonly prescient hitman. And just for good measure, a pair of teenage boys held as hostages gets thrown into the mix because 17 years old. And I say it's easy to envision a teenager coming up with this because a teenager did come up with this, specifically star/writer/director Jack Fessenden, son of horror impresario Larry Fessenden, a man who here not only appears as one of the criminals, but also serves as cinematographer. With Daddy so close to his kid's side, there is some sense that this was more of a father-son project, only with a father that could recruit the likes of James LaGrosse and Kevin Corrigan as co-stars. This is the kind of thing that typically gets done without public exposure, an exercise to get one's feet wet in the art before moving on to find one's own voice. The younger Fessenden has apparently not yet learned that a story does need a point. The film ended with me going, wait, what? But it does have its entertaining moments. A new cinematic eye has not yet emerged with Stray Bullets, but there's stuff here to suggest young Jack should, at the very least, keep exploring. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
I switched my mic. Ah, okay, I'm one of these, because now I can hear myself on the headphones and I can draw a level. The control room mic, my mic, the announcer's mic, is to use, this is not one of the seven words you must not use, but it's Verschlungen. Okay, it's number three up. Ellen, if you look at that list there, it's the seven words you must not use.
Where?
To your right. To your far right.
Oh, yes.
As it were. And it is from the far right.
Okay.
So you see, when I want to curse, this S-P-F-C-C-M-T, right? Mm-hmm. So when I want to curse, I'll say number three.
I'm surprised you can't say P.
I'm sorry?
I mean, I'm surprised you can't say number two. That seems
you can't say piss? That would piss me off. You can. You can also say number seven.
Yeah, see, why not?
Yeah, talking to your mic. You see, the problem with those are not FCC violations. Mm-hmm. That was Carlin's list.
Oh.
That was George. Those were the seven words that George Carlin chose.
Okay.
And what WBAI got taken to the Supreme Court for was for playing Carlin's seven words you can't say
right,
on television.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
The reason we lost, and the only reason we lost that case, was because it was broadcast on a Saturday at 2 in the afternoon.
Oh, right. Yeah, it had to be after prime time.
Yeah, I mean, it's when little kids could be listening.
Yeah.
So it was...
And hey, Mommy, what does that mean?
Exactly. Exactly. So there was a test case for what time of day. Say, well, what was 5 a.m.? Little kids should not be listening unattended. And if they are, we should ask the parents. So I had on Hour of the Wolf a gentleman by the name of Harlan something or Ellison. And he read the premiere of a short story called Shatterday, which is a great story. It's a 45-minute story, and all the curse words come in the first half hour, and the last 15 minutes were clean. So I timed it. I recorded him the night before at the School of Visual Arts, where he was reading for Leo and Diane Dillon. And I broadcast the thing, and all the naughty bits were over by 6 a.m., although the story continued to 6:15.
Right.
And I was suspended by the FCC, and the Department of Justice told the FCC, drop the case.
Good.
And so we didn't win, but that's what established safe harbor.
Right.
But you see, so those words are misinterpreted by, let's say, the management of some radio stations, ours, to be that that is the list.
Right.
But it isn't. Those are Carlin's words.
Right.
And he says, this shouldn't even be one of the words. And he's right. It's not. Because these words are commonly found on primetime television. Have you seen a TV series called The Good Place?
No, I don't watch television.
Oh, that's right. It's shockingly decent, and it got really good at the end. And it all takes place in heaven. You can't curse. So the lead character, who's supposed to be a bad person who got into heaven by accident, is trying to hide the fact, is constantly saying it's all forked up. Well, that's on TV at 8:30 in prime time. So
there's leeway.
There's leeway. There is. But then again, that was during the Obama administration. There's a new FCC commissioner, and I don't think he's our friend.
No.
Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning.
Ellen Datlow has won how many awards? Nominated for how? Ellen Datlow's the best editor.
Thank you. One of, maybe.
One of the, but... nominated pretty much every year in the Hugo Awards for that. And how many? You have an amazing amount of metal behind your kittens or cats, depending on their age, on your shelf.
Well, actually, my awards are on my armoire. The cats can't get up there.
No, that's right. That's right.
And they're not metal. I mean, not all of them are metal.
Now, the Howie is metal, isn't it?
The Howie is not metal. It's resin.
It's resin. Serves him right. We're talking about H.P. Lovecraft.
Although the new award's going to be metal. of some sort. Which I can't talk about.
Oh,
It'll be unveiled at the next convention.
At the next World Fantasy Convention in October.
I think it's November.
Because
I'm not sure.
Lovecraft was such a horrid, horrid racist that it has been determined that that person should not stand for the world's best fantasy. And so there was a movement to replace it, which the movement won. And what the new award is going to be is a deep, dark secret.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. How many people made that decision?
You mean of what it is?
Yes.
Well, we had a competition. We had people submitting, artists submitting designs.
Ah!
We had, I think, three or four runners-up.
Mm-hmm.
We had two semifinalists, and we chose one.
Cool.
And is it going to be this? That was decided by the awards administration, although it was approved by the whole board, the winner.
And the World Fantasy Award, the Nebula Awards, the nominations of which closed 90 minutes ago, are voted upon by members of the Science Fiction Writers of America. The Hugo Awards, famously, if you're in the field, are
voted upon by any member from a few years before and the current year.
Yeah. But the World Fantasy Award is a juried.
Yes, but there are nominations. The nominations are open to people who have been members of the World Fantasy Convention. I forget how many years, a year or two.
I think two.
And then the current year.
Yeah.
And the there are, I think, the top two. I'm not sure. I can't remember how many, but a couple of those become the finalists, and then the judges put on.
And you're often one of those judges.
I'm never. No.
I
no,
think
never.
You were.
No, you're only allowed to be a judge once. I was a judge in 1987.
Well, that was good enough for me.
And that was plenty, believe me. No one has ever judged twice. No, it's. Well, actually, maybe very, very early on before. Someone might have been a judge twice, but no one. Once you're a judge, you never have to do it again, and that's one of the selling points.
Well, that's actually a blessing, exactly.
Yes.
I have had my. Is it going to be the same design every year?
Yes.
Okay.
Although we're still going to have the baby Lovecraft pins. We have hundreds. I have hundreds of them. For the nominees, we'll get the baby Lovecrafts. I have them many in my possession. And we're not going to, I mean, we're never going to run out of those.
Yeah.
There's so many.
Okay. And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had my opinion as to what the award should be and that it should change every year. It should be prohibitively expensive. But in my fantasy,
yeah,
it would be a dragon.
Because
because every culture has a dragon. There are Chinese dragons. Mm-hmm. There are South American dragons. Mm-hmm. There are British.
I can see what you're saying. Yeah, we didn't want it. Well, we wanted to be a little less literal.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And we got something that we're really happy with.
Good. I'm looking forward to seeing
it. I'm sure everyone's going to hate, but tough luck.
Well, you're not going to get...
Right. I mean, the people who wanted to keep it the Howie... are going to hate it, and the people who wanted something else are going to hate it, and we don't care. It's beautiful, and it's going to be a very nice award.
Yeah, and you can't say that the Lovecraft Awards were beautiful.
Well, I thought it was cute, though.
They are cute. It is such a cartoonish...
Well, that was the intention. I mean, it's caricature by Gay and Wilson.
Yeah, and you take one look at it, and you can't say, we are honoring this... wonderful human being.
No, it's the honoring the winner.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was, I mean, it was created at a time in 1975 or whenever. And it was, Gay and Wilson volunteered to create the award, and he created this statuette.
Yeah.
And as offensive as Lovecraft's beliefs were,
seep their way into some of his fiction.
But he has been a great influence on fantasy, dark fantasy.
Absolutely.
And you can't deny that. And that's never going to go away, and it shouldn't. But, obviously, some people think that, I made the decision. I did not make the decision. It was a decision by the whole board, not just the awards administration, but the entire overall board. which was run by David Hartwell at the time, to change the award.
Yeah.
And, you know, it took a while. Well, partly it took a long time because we were trying to reach Gahan to talk to him, to let him know in advance. And he was we were unable to reach him for about 8 months. Mm. And finally we gave up and just wrote him a letter. I think he's not well. So
I'm sorry to hear that.
I mean, I'm assuming because I haven't been able to reach him.
Lovely guy.
We used to have lunch about twice a year or three times a year.
Does he still live where he used to live?
He's living in New York someplace. I mean, I know I have his address. I finally wrote him a letter, but he never responded.
Because he used to live within walking
distance. He lived
in
Sag Harbor.
Yes.
Yeah.
He had a place in Sag Harbor, but he also had a New York.
No, not for a long time. But then he left the place in Sag. I mean, maybe at one time he did, but not for decades.
Well, okay.
And then he, about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, he left Sag Harbor and moved back to New York full time.
Okay. So no doubt not in the place where he used to be.
No.
Yeah.
No. So, you know, we were trying to, we wanted to talk to Gahan in person about it and talk, you know, about that it was time to retire the award.
Yeah.
And that we appreciated what he did.
He's still, I see him once every 4 or 5 months in the New Yorker.
Right. I mean, I assume he's still producing cartoons,
yeah,
I hope.
Yeah, he is. Well, stuff is appearing, whether it's from the trunk or whether he's drawing new stuff.
I don't know,
but he's selling stuff. But then again, I saw a Charles Adams cartoon I'd never seen about a year ago. Mm-hmm. So
there might have been stuff, you know, stashed
discovered
away
somewhere. Yeah,
right.
No doubt. Ellen Datlow, for those who don't know, is an, we said she's an editor, but primarily at this time of dark fantasy and horror.
No, mostly horror. No, I don't do dark fantasy.
You don't do that anymore.
Very little.
There was horror.
I've never done dark fantasy. I mean, I edit some dark fantasy, some fantasy, but basically I edit horror. There is a difference, and I don't.
There is,
you know,
a big difference.
No, there's a little difference. I mean, it overlaps. But anyway,
I will never get this.
Although I've been editing more science fiction for Tor.com. I mean, I acquired like 4 stories that were science fiction last year that were on Tor.com.
Yeah.
And I've been encouraging people to send, you know, my writers. It took me, because I haven't been editing science fiction in so long, it was really hard to get people to send me science fiction. And luckily, finally, after like 2 years of begging, you know, I got some.
Ellen,
but I'm doing science fiction, fantasy, and horror for Tor.com.
Cool. There was a time when Ellen was so far ahead of the curve with bringing Omni magazine, where you were the fiction editor at Omni, and with a stalwarty crew, brought Omni Online into existence.
Mm-hmm.
And then, lo and behold, something that today would be commonplace, Event Horizon, which was a website of original fiction and live chats.
And reprints.
I have recovered every last one of the chats.
Wow.
Using archive.org.
Wow.
And I fashion that needs tweaking and all.
Well,
that.
They were a mess. I mean, don't forget, a lot of them were phoners because the writers did not know how to get online.
That's right.
Well, it wasn't even online. They didn't know how to do chats. I mean, we had to do it by phone and we typed for them.
Yes.
And that started in Omni. We started doing those in Omni.
Right. Because it was me and Ed Bryant, who just passed away.
Yeah.
And
Janice something.
Yeah.
Janice Mars? I forget. I'm sorry. I can't remember her last name.
And there was somebody named Pete something?
That doesn't sound familiar. I don't know.
Well, I recovered these by going to archive.org.
Mm-hmm.
And actually able to get into, believe it or not, the old, both Event Horizon and Omni website.
Well, the interesting...
And I could only recover text, but that's all I wanted.
Right. Well, and interesting, I was just talking about this on... had a discussion on the Lovecraft e-zine last Sunday night, and one thing I mentioned was Omni, before we went online, like you go to a website online.
Yeah.
A few years before that, we... Remember when AOL had content? Right. Well, I think it was Ford, some automobile company gave us lots of money to commission novellas to put on AOL someplace. I never did figure out where the hell they were on AOL. I mean, they were in some back long? I don't know. I have no idea where they were.
They're probably, because AOL...
But where were they? I mean, how... Did you know... Did you ever find them on AOL? Did you see them on AOL? I mean, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes, but I'm...
But where did they go? I mean, where were they published? That's what I can't figure out.
If you do a search on archive.org, which has recently gotten a new flow of money, and they have redone their search engines, engines that go all the way back to basically 1996 or so, it can be found.
Well, I want to find
text
it. Just
to, only.
Well, that's all right. I want to find it because I want to see where it actually was. I mean, I just want to track it down. It's so weird.
But Ellen's creation stewardship of sci fiction for I call it the syphilis channel, the sci-fi channel. It's now S-Y-F-Y, that's why it's syphilis.
I know.
The best thing about the sci-fi channel when it premiered...
Website to me. Oh, the channel itself, yeah.
The channel was that they also had a sister website.
Yes.
And you were the fiction editor.
Mm-hmm.
And in the year...
is originally called... Now I can't remember. It was called something not sci-fi.com.
Sci-fiction.
No, it was not called sci-fi.com. It was called the something. The website was called something completely different.
Was it? Okay.
And I used to remember what it was. If Craig Engler is listening out there,
yes,
he would remember. I don't remember what it was called, but some weird name not to do with science fiction. And then it became sci-fi.com. But what the heck? Do you remember? You don't remember this?
I don't, because frankly...
Wait, the Dominion. It was called the Dominion.
Oh, that's right. After DS9, after Deep
Space
Nine.
Which I never watched, so I have no idea where it came from.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, is that... Okay, so yes, it was originally called the Dominion. I don't... By the time I got there, it was sci-fi.com.
Yeah, but your section of it was
sci-fiction. Yes.
And I know that if I use Alta Vista, which was the search engine of the day, and just typed in sci fiction, it would take me to the page I wanted.
Now?
Then.
Oh, yeah.
Then. Now if you go to internet...
It should be all gone.
No. Really? I mean, it is and it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Archive.org never forgets.
Even though they took things down?
That's the whole point of archive.org.
Don't tell people, because then they'll find the stories.
It's a non...
Is that like the Wayback Machine or something different?
The Wayback Machine is a part of archive.org.
Okay.
Yes.
I mean, I can find Event Horizon sometimes.
That's
on the
right.
Wayback,
that's
although
right.
It's also on Pam Weintraub's site.
Right. But Wayback has just been renovated.
Okay.
To have a better interface.
Okay.
And they still have that's so Wayback is a part of archive.org. All the WBAI folios can be found. You know, there's print can be done in PDF format, which is how we know that this is the 45th anniversary of Hour of the Wolf, was thanks to archive.org. Because my memory is for Bupkis. But the very year that the corporate Uber structure over the Sci-Fi Channel and sci-fiction and all that, the very year that they decided to pull the plug on that website was...
They didn't. They never pulled the plug.
Who pulled
Sci-fi.com is still there, isn't it?
Yes, but sci-fiction.
Well, they pulled different parts of it at different times. Well, we were one of the last that was left that was original material in addition
The year it was taken off was the year that you published There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes, and you had like four award-nominated stories, some of the best stuff from any one source came out from you in that year.
I didn't notice. I mean, I don't
remember. Did. Mm-hmm. I did. I can document it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all just to tell listeners, not so much historic accuracy as how important Ellen Datlow is to the genre field, which I call science fiction.
Well, I say science fiction, fantasy, and horror.
But, in fact, encompasses all, you know, spec fic, which was a term invented by Heinlein.
It was?
It was. 1946. Robert Heinlein wrote an essay in which he coined the term speculative fiction. And by that, by the way, he meant hard science fiction only.
Well, that's interesting. Okay.
The kind of stuff that various puppies would embrace. Mm-hmm. Without getting
into because spec fic now is basically...
It's almost the opposite.
Yeah.
Interstitial, it's the stuff you can't quite define. Kelly Link is a poster child of speculative fiction, among other great writers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good. I like the phrase because it's all-encompassing.
Mm-hmm.
David Hartwell once had a chapter in his book Age of Wonders, and the chapter title was Why Science Fiction is the Wrong and Only Name for It. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that he was definitively correct,
mm-hmm.
but I do know that it's a clever idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because I can't go on the air all the time and say, it's horror, it's fantasy, it's mm-hmm. high fantasy, it's dark fantasy, it's science fiction, it's hard science fiction.
It's science fantasy.
It's science, mm-hmm. yes, thank you, like Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. I don't consider, science fantasy is...
You wouldn't think Star Wars is science fantasy?
I don't talk about movies, I mean, I'm talking right. about literature. And Michael Swanwick writes science fantasy. Science fiction that reads like fantasy, and then there's fantasy that reads like science fiction.
He writes fantasy that reads like science fiction. I mean,
yeah.
Iron Dragon's Daughter, mm-hmm. everybody listening,
yeah.
that and the Towers of Babel.
And the one, he wrote something called the Towers of
Not
Babel?
Not the Towers of Babel, that's Delaney.
That's also Ted Chiang. Tower of Babylon. But anyway, I'm sorry.
He's Babylon.
Who are we talking about? Michael Swanwick. The one Radio Waves that won something, yes. The Hugo and the Nebula,
yeah.
that I published. Or World Fantasy. I can't remember what it wrote. But anyway, that was science fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah, he writes fantasy science and science fantasy.
And science fiction.
And but what he writes is he writes brilliant.
Yes. Yeah.
We'll agree on that one.
Mm-hmm.
He's just wonderful. I once introduced him on the air as a person who's been nominated for more awards than any other single writer. And he said, yes, which means that I've lost more awards than anybody.
Yeah.
Which is pure Swanwick.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful person.
Yes.
So a couple of things we need to get out of the way. One is that this is a fundraising program. We're part of the marathon, and I have been granted this week. I'm preempted next week. I won't be on, and don't know about the week after. But I'm on this week on the theory that we can raise money for WBAI, listener-sponsored radio. And Ellen's publishers of one of her brand new books, and if you go to WBAI.org, you will see the wonderful cover.
Ravina Kai.
Yeah.
I think it's pronounced Kai. Actually, C-A-I, so I assume Kai, not K, but I don't know.
What is the language derivation?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I have never met her. I don't even know what she looks like.
It's Kai or K.
Yeah.
I would assume Kai. Mm-hmm. K-A-I is certainly Kai.
Is it? Okay.
Like Kai Ashanti
right,
Wilson.
Right, yeah.
Is K-A-I.
Mm-hmm.
So
anyway, it's a wonderful cover.
It's a wonderful cover. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you. You don't know. You haven't read it yet, have you?
I have looked through it. Okay, I have not read it. But I have certainly looked through the table of contents because mm-hmm. your publicists were not only dead on in getting me a copy like the next day
mm-hmm.
after you and I shared emails, but they sent us 5 copies of this book.
Good, good. And I'll even sign them.
And
not to anyone, obviously.
For listeners who subscribe to WBAI during this program. But it's not just subscribe. What we are asking is a donation of $40. If you donate $40 to WBAI, we will give you, as a thank you gift, see, we're not selling.
No.
This is a thank you gift for your donation of $40. May I point out that when I started at WBAI in 1967, a regular subscription was $45, mm-hmm. and $25 for a student, retired, or unemployed. We are asking for less of a donation than the regular subscription to BAI until somewhere in the 80s or 90s. To obtain an autographed copy of Black Feather's Dark Avian Tales, an anthology. It's the whole proper name is a mouthful.
Yeah, Kim Newman said, "Well, I said I don't want to call it bird horror." I said, "No, it's not as graceful."
No, it really isn't. Bird droppings. It's,
I said, "No, I want to call it Dark Avian Tales. What do you want for
yes.
my life?"
Exactly. It's, well, you can always crow about it.
That's bad.
Let's not go there. Let's not go there. The way you can do this is by calling right now at area code 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602.
It's a beautiful hardcover, by the way.
Yes, it is. Or go to the website give2wbai.org, and then you can search for Hour of the Wolf. And then you will see the premium, or you can just go to the premiums area, or the gifts area, it might be called, and you will see the cover of the book. You can look under Dark Feathers, Black Feathers, sorry, and it will be there. And we only have 5 copies. Now, should enough people donate, we'll get more copies.
Mm-hmm.
We may have to buy them,
mm-hmm.
but we will fulfill this. But we have 5 that were donated thanks to
Pegasus
Publishing. Nice imprint, by the way. Very, very mm-hmm. lovely job on the book. And I'm yeah. talking about the quality of the paper. It feels like a mm-hmm. good old-time hardcover with a very nice...
Oh, I didn't even look at that.
Yeah, you see, I do. I do. I always take the cover off.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And, that's a pretty color.
Yes.
Copper-colored... Whatever you call it.
Oh, dear.
And it gleams.
I should know, yeah. But embossing.
Embossing. For the...
The embossed print on the spine.
Thank you, spine. Yes.
Yeah, on the spine. And let us tell you a little something about this book that you can obtain by calling 516-620-3602 and donating to WBAI. Let us go through the table of contents. You want to take a copy out
sure.
of the box that was sent
Thank
to
you,
us?
So we can both look at it.
Yeah.
And actually, the print on the cover is raised.
Yes. It's properly embossed.
Is that? But is it embossing when it's on over?
Yes.
Not engraved, you know. I thought, well, whatever. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it does. I love etymology. Mm. So, Oh Terrible Bird by Sandra Castori.
It's a poem. That's the only poem in it.
Okay. Followed by The Obscure Bird by Nicholas Royal,
yes, there are
who
two
I don't know.
There are two, he's British. There are two reprints in it. One of them is this one. Nick Royal is a writer. He also runs... He was an editor for Salt Press in England, and he's a publisher of Nightjar Press, which publishes very... limited runs of single story chapbooks
mm-hmm.
that are very
which I love.
Yeah,
I love the unusual.
Yeah. And there's another Nicholas Royal who is not him, who's also a writer in England. So it
same spelling R O Y L E.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, but I don't think he writes horror. I mean, Nick writes horror mostly.
Right. The Mathematical Inevitability of Corvids. Corvids are ravens, crows,
blackbirds.
No.
No? Blackbirds
I
are not?
I don't believe blackbirds are corvids.
I don't know.
No, I'm pretty sure they're not.
Okay.
Corvids are almost all black, and blackbirds...
Blackbirds are black.
They have red wings and yellow speculum.
Red-winged blackbird. You know,
red-winged?
There are not blackbirds that don't have...
No, there aren't. Okay. The African blackbird... Barbara and I go birding.
Oh, okay.
And worse than that, I am addicted now. I am addicted to a six-hour internet TV show every day that takes place in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It's live.
Okay.
Where you watch people on safari, well, on camera safari.
My sister might like that. She's a birder.
Yeah. Well, it's birds, it's hippos, it's elephants, it's lions, leopards, cougars, but a lot of birds, hornbills.
Okay, let's go back.
And corvids.
So that's Sean and Maguire.
And that's Sean and Maguire.
Yes.
Something About Birds by Paul Tremblay, a wonderful human being and a good writer.
Mm-hmm.
Great Blue Heron. I last saw a great blue heron about 4 months ago at Jamaica Bay. They're gorgeous. They're mm-hmm. great. They're blue.
Mm-hmm.
They're herons. And it's Joyce Carol Oates. So, you know. The Season of the Raptors, Richard Bowes.